Now, the Christian life involves trials. Anyone who says that it doesn't is either hopelessly naive or horribly dishonest. Trials come in all shapes and sizes. There are persistent, unspectacular, wearing trials, which other people may barely notice that we're experiencing. And there are explosive, calamitous, devastating trials, which nobody can possibly overlook. But whatever form they may take, trials, as I say, are inevitable. They can't be avoided. You can't opt out of them. You can't politely decline them as they come your way. The Christian life involves trials. And as believers, then, we have to develop strategies for handling trials. We have to develop coping mechanisms. Of course, the bottom line is Jesus' great assurance to the Apostle Paul when he was going through the mill. My grace is sufficient for you. That's ultimately how we cope. That's the bottom line. But that doesn't mean that we just kind of wait for Christ's sustaining grace to kick in like magic whenever we're in the face of a trial. No, Christ's sustaining grace uses means. It's proper for us to be as prepared as possible for frustrations and disappointments and pain and heartache. And in particular, we need truths which we can focus on and that will steady us in the face of trials. And what we're going to do this morning is consider two such truths. Two truths which should keep us from being as disorientated as we might otherwise be when trials rear their heads. And the reason we're going to consider them is that they are, I think, legitimate inferences from this text that we've come to in our studies in the book of Exodus, chapter 18, verses 1 to 12. And it's very much in relation to that passage, then, that we're going to consider these two truths. So notice with me first this morning the consequences of our trials. That's the first truth that we need to be clear on and that will hopefully secure us and steady us, the consequences of our trials. So let's get into this passage a bit, and I want to take you to verses 2 and 3, where we make a surprising discovery about Moses' domestic arrangements. He had sent, we're told there, he had sent his wife Zipporah and his two sons home, that is Zipporah's original home in the land of Midian. Presumably, it was in order to protect his family that he had done this. His mission in Egypt involved him from the outset being a stench in Pharaoh's nostrils, and his becoming a stench in the Israelites' nostrils didn't lag very far behind. As soon as Pharaoh, as a result of Moses' interference, ordered them to find their own straw, they became pretty disgruntled with Moses. And it was natural, therefore, having made so many enemies in Egypt, having become to different parties for different reasons a persona non grata, it was natural that Moses should fear for the safety of his wife and boys. And it was probably around that time then when things were so tense that he had taken this drastic step that we read of there in verses 2 and 3 and had parted company with Zipporah and the two boys, sending them off far away from Egypt to find asylum with Jethro. And it must have been hard for Moses. The parting itself must have been hard as he stood on the road watching them gradually disappear from view. But then the subsequent weeks and months must have been hard. Of course, Moses continued to be a stench in Pharaoh's nostrils right up to the Exodus itself. As for the Israelites, they warmed to him as they departed Egypt, but in the wilderness afterwards, they soon turned against him again. At one point, you remember, they were even on the verge of stoning him. And against that backdrop, how Moses could have done with a few people around him who loved him unconditionally. People he could come home to at the end of a long and stressful day, to whom he wasn't the leader of the Israelites, but just a husband, just a dad. How stabilizing a bit of domestic normality would have been in the face of Pharaoh's rage and Israel's disaffection. But he didn't have that domestic normality. When he most needed a reassuring I love you from Zipporah, a heartwarming hug from the boys, he had no access to those things. No shelter from the storm of hostility, no comforting distraction. Ordinarily, his nearest and dearest would have fulfilled that role, but in his hour of greatest need, they couldn't do so. And perhaps moreover, in the absence of his family, he had to cope with voices in his head saying, "They've forgotten you now, Moses. They're settled in Midian and they're not interested in you anymore. In fact, if they were here right now, Moses, they'd be utterly unsupportive. They'd be picking up stones with everyone else in order to throw them at you." I'm saying the situation that we are told of there in verses 2 and 3, this separation from his loved ones, this loss of his most natural support network, it must have been really hard for Moses. It must have been a deeply painful business for him. Now, for a couple of minutes, I just want you to park that thought. And I want us to turn our attention to the main event that is recorded here in this passage. The main event recorded in the passage is Jethro becoming a worshipper of Yahweh. I don't think the story of Jethro generates the same kind of hype in evangelical circles that the story of Ruth does. I mean, that scene where they're on the road out of Moab and Naomi tells Ruth to go back home and it looks like these two women are going to be parted, never to see each other again. But then Ruth suddenly seizes the moment and makes her famous speech. It's all so poignant, isn't it? It's all so cinematic almost. We all love the story of Ruth. But actually, the story of Jethro is of the same order, you know, as the story of Ruth. Like Ruth, Jethro is an out-and-out pagan Gentile. Indeed, it's not merely that he practices Midianite religion, he's a priest. Perhaps the leading priest, the most important figure within Midianite religion. That may be the significance of the definite article, the priest of Midian, Exodus keeps calling him. And like Ruth, Jethro is emphatically converted to Yahweh. Notice the different ways in which his conversion is expressed. It's expressed emotionally. There in verse 9, Jethro rejoiced for all the good that the Lord had done to Israel. It's expressed verbally in verses 10 and 11. Actually, his statement there, "Now I know that, verse 11, that's very similar to that of other Gentile converts in the Old Testament. The widow of Zarephath to Elijah, 1 Kings 17, 24, "Now I know that you are a man of God and that the word of Yahweh in your mouth is true." And then Naaman, 2 Kings 5, 15, "But I know that there is no God in all the earth but in Israel." So it's expressed emotionally, this conversion. It's expressed verbally, and then it's expressed religiously. Verse 12, "Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, brought a burnt offering and sacrifices to God." So this is wonderful stuff. It's wonderful stuff. A man thoroughly immersed in heathen idolatry, unambiguously embracing the living and true God. It's a thrilling moment. But here's my question. How does it come about? How does it come about? Well, not through Jethro merely hearing on the grapevine that Yahweh has carried out this great deliverance of his people from Egypt. That's not what triggers the conversion. And that needs to be said, because according to verse 1, Jethro does hear on the grapevine about the deliverance. And a sloppy reading of the passage then might lead someone to conclude Jethro heard the rumors and bowed the knee to Yahweh. But that's not what happens. Verse 1 isn't recording Jethro's conversion, simply that he heard of the Exodus, just like many other people also heard of the Exodus. The Amalekites presumably heard of the Exodus, and they thought, there's a chance here for us to have a go at this now homeless people group. Later, the people of Jericho had heard of the Exodus. And apart from one of them, they all thought, well, we better resist these Israelites, hadn't we, by keeping our gates tightly shut at night and dealing with any spies that happened to come our way. Hearing of the Exodus, I'm saying, is certainly not the same as becoming a worshipper of Yahweh. The two things are quite different. And in verse 1 here, Jethro's response to hearing of the Exodus, well, it may have been one of sincere interest, it may have been one of acute skepticism, but it was not conversion to Israel's God. It was not conversion to Israel's God. No, the crucial moment is there in verse 8. It's Jethro sitting in that tent with Moses and hearing directly of Yahweh's deliverance. That's the catalyst for the marvelous scenes in verses 9 to 12. I mentioned the widow of Zarephath and Naaman. And in both those cases, the "now I know" was a response to a specific, decisive, pivotal moment. The widow of Zarephath is saying, "Before this raising of my son back to life happened, I didn't know. But now, on the basis of that happening, I do know." That's what she's saying. Naaman is saying, "Before this healing of my leprosy happened, I didn't know. But now, on the basis of that happening, I know." And it's the same with Jethro's exclamation there in verse 11. He's saying there's been a decisive, pivotal moment right here, right now. He's saying before this face-to-face meeting and conversation with Moses happened, "I didn't know. I didn't know that Yahweh is greater than all gods. I didn't know that when I was in Midian. I didn't know that even when in Midian I heard all the rumors and all the stories coming my way. But now, on the basis of this face-to-face meeting and conversation with Moses happening, now I know that Yahweh is greater than all gods." So Jethro's conversion comes about through him hearing directly from Moses of Yahweh's deliverance. But how does that come about? Well, that's easy. It comes about through Jethro visiting Moses there at his wilderness encampment. Okay, but how does that come about? Jethro visiting Moses there at his wilderness encampment. Well, you might say, why shouldn't it come about? Jethro is Moses' father-in-law, for goodness sake. There's no big deal about him visiting Moses. My parents-in-law come up from Newcastle a couple of times a year, and it's not particularly remarkable that Jethro should do the same here and visit Moses, except that it is actually. It is actually. Jethro couldn't catch the megabus like my parents-in-law can from South Wales. In all seriousness, casual visiting like that over long distances didn't really happen much in those days. You didn't venture on a major journey with all its associated dangers and disruption to life simply because you wanted to hang out with friends or family whom you hadn't seen for a while. To put it bluntly, on that day, back in chapter 4, when Moses took his family and left Midian, bound for Egypt, bound to lead a people, in fact, from Egypt to another land, to the land of Canaan, on that day, there was no reason to expect that Moses and Jethro would ever cross paths again. Indeed, their paths were now diverging so sharply, there was every reason to expect that they wouldn't cross again. Actually, you can sense in our passage, can't you, how rare and special this visit from Jethro is. The way in which Jethro, without the convenience of WhatsApp or text messaging at his disposal, nonetheless sends word to Moses of his impending visit, verse 6. He doesn't just turn up on the doorstep. And the way in which, for Moses, having his father-in-law around isn't just some sort of background, barely noticed thing as he gets on with his busy schedule. No, in verse 7, his busy schedule goes out of the window. And we read there that he went out to meet his father-in-law and he bowed down and he kissed him and they then asked each other of their welfare and then they went to the tent. This is a big thing. Someone from a chapter of Moses' life that was long since over, the Midianite chapter, is now making a surprise re-entry into the story. Which brings us back to my question then. If Jethro visiting Moses is such a remarkable occurrence, a development which back in chapter 4 no one would have thought remotely likely, how does it come about? Well, it comes about because Moses had had to send his wife and sons away. They had been with Jethro, and Jethro now needs to return them to Moses. That's why the two men's paths cross again. If Moses hadn't had to send his wife and sons away, Jethro would probably never have made this kind of journey and re-entered his son-in-law's life. And you see what's happening here then. Jethro becomes a worshipper of Yahweh through hearing directly from Moses of Yahweh's stunning deliverance. Jethro hears directly from Moses of Yahweh's stunning deliverance because he visits Moses, and Jethro visits Moses because Moses had had to send away his wife and his sons. In other words, Jethro's conversion, this marvelous moment in the Old Testament story, which I'm saying is up there with Ruth's conversion, Jethro's conversion is a consequence of that terribly painful trial which Moses had had to undergo. The trial with all its tears and bitterness for Moses. The trial set in motion a sequence of events which culminated in a Midianite priest crying out, now I know that Yahweh is greater than all gods. That's quite something, isn't it? Actually, we could take this further, because Jethro's conversion itself then sets in motion a sequence of events. We read in Judges chapter 1, verse 16, of Jethro's descendants being by then a kind of subset of the tribe of Judah, presumably because following his conversion, Jethro had thrown in his lot with the people of God, had become part of Israel. And then later on in Judges, you'll perhaps remember, it's the wife of one of Jethro's descendants who seals one of the greatest victories that God's people enjoy in the whole Old Testament, Jael. She's the wife of Heber, who is a descendant of Jethro. And it's she who takes that tent peg and hammers it through the head of Israel's enemy, Sisera. That too, I'm saying. That epic triumph immortalized in Deborah and Barak's song, it can be traced back to Moses losing for a while his precious family members. Without that, there would have been no descendant of Jethro living in the land of Canaan ready to waylay the fleeing Sisera. It too is ultimately a consequence of Moses' painful trial. So how come? How come all these splendid consequences flowing from Moses' dreadful trial? Well, because God never meaninglessly, purposelessly afflicts his people. When he afflicts his people, when he sends trials into their lives, it's always with a purpose. Always with a view to some welcome, desirable consequence. That consequence might be the refinement of the person experiencing the trial. Or it might be the conversion of someone connected to the person experiencing the trial, the conversion of a Jethro. Or it might be something else altogether, something further removed from the trial itself, linked to it in a much more convoluted way, something perhaps which the person experiencing the trial never even becomes aware of. But God always has some reason, some plan that he is working out. There's a classic Mr. Bean episode in which he visits the dentist to have a filling done. Some of you will have seen it, and he's sitting there in the dentist chair, and various initial mishaps occur, so that for reasons I won't go into, the dentist ends up collapsed in a heap on the floor. Mr. Bean, however, is unfazed by this and decides that he's just going to do the filling himself. All the necessary implements are there. How hard can it be? And so he looks carefully at the x-ray image of his mouth. He sees where the rotten tooth is, that it's this number of teeth in from the left. And so he counts his own teeth with his finger, he finds the one, and he does the filling. Feeling rather pleased with himself, he's about to get up when he suddenly realizes he might have looked at the x-ray image the wrong way round. In which case, the rotten tooth would be that many in from the right rather than that many in from the left. And so just to make sure, he counts his teeth from the other side of his mouth and does the filling on that tooth as well. But then it strikes him that the x-ray image might be not only the wrong way around, or it might not be the wrong way around, it might be the wrong way up instead. So that he's been concentrating on his bottom teeth when the rotten tooth is in fact in his top teeth. And so just to make sure, he performs a filling on the relevant top tooth as well. But he's still worried because there's always the possibility the x-ray image was both the wrong way around and the wrong way up. And so thoroughly confused by this point, he decides just to do a filling on every single one of his teeth. And that's what he does. There was only one rotten tooth. Only one tooth needed to suffer during that visit to the dentist. The suffering endured by all those other teeth was futile, pointless, the result of incompetence and ham-fistedness. When God sends trials into our lives, there's no incompetence and ham-fistedness. He doesn't heap a whole dollop of suffering on us when only a small measure is necessary. There's no wasted pain with God. He's precise and meticulous. He knows the good thing which he wants to accomplish, the character renovation, the conversion, whatever it might be, and he knows exactly the trial that's required to accomplish it. And that's what he sends, no less, no more. And I'm saying this is a truth then, which you and I need to have in our mental armory, ready to draw upon when trials hit us. Our trials are not senseless. God isn't frantically performing fillings right, left and centre, not really knowing what he's doing. Rather, our trials are just the right trials for the wholesome consequences which God has in mind. He separates Moses from his precious family, which at that time in Moses' life especially just seems irremediably sad. But as he separates Moses from his precious family, he opens up this extraordinary path to the conversion of Jethro and to the far-off demise even of Israel's enemy, Sisera. It's a grand truth. It's a steadying truth. This truth that God, in our trials, is always working perfectly toward the good consequences that he has predesigned. So that's the first thing. We need to fix our minds in the face of trials on the consequences of our trials. But then notice with me, secondly and more briefly, the context of our trials. The context of our trials. This is the second truth we need to be clear on to prepare ourselves for adversity. The context of our trials. So we've talked about that face-to-face meeting that Jethro and Moses have there in the tent. Let's look at what Moses actually said there to his father-in-law. And much of it is exactly what you would expect, but one bit of it isn't. So there in verse 8 we read, "Then Moses told his father-in-law all that the Lord had done to Pharaoh and to the Egyptians for Israel's sake." That makes sense, doesn't it? You jump to the end of the verse, "and how the Lord had delivered them." That makes sense as well. It's the bit in between that doesn't make quite so much sense. He told his father-in-law all that the Lord had done to Pharaoh and to the Egyptians for Israel's sake, all the hardship that had come upon them in the way. Moses told Jethro of all the hardship that had come upon the Israelites in the way. Presumably it's a reference to the recent difficulties involved in living in that barren wilderness. I mean, it's easy enough for us, isn't it, to immediately associate that period of Israel's history with manna and with water gushing from the rock. But of course, the manna and the water from the rock had only come after bouts of real hunger and real thirst, which would have been very unpleasant indeed. Remember, we're not talking here about some elite SAS troop passing through the wilderness. We're talking about a nation replete with pregnant and breastfeeding women, replete with the elderly and the infirm, replete with animals livestock that desperately needed feeding. This would have been really, really hard. Really, really hard for the Israelites to be without basic necessities for a number of hours, let alone a number of days before the manna, before the water from the rock were provided. So truly that could be described as the hardship that had come upon them in the way. But the inclusion then of that item there in verse 8, it's intriguing for two reasons. For one thing, Moses presumably wants Jethro to become a worshipper of Yahweh. And you'd have thought, therefore, that he might edit out the hardship, that he might miss out conveniently that bit of the story. Because surely it's not calculated to produce in Jethro the desired effect, the conversion that Moses wants to the true and the living God. It's surely better if Jethro isn't told that the God who sends deliverances also sends trials. And then the other intriguing thing is that it doesn't in fact thwart the conversion. The inclusion in Moses' report of all the hardship that Israel had experienced there in the wilderness, it doesn't remotely thwart Jethro's conversion. Jethro doesn't seem to notice really that awkward detail. He doesn't say, hang on a minute, this God of yours seems a bit of a mixed bag to me. I'm not sure I can surrender my life to a deity who puts difficulties across his people's paths. No, we read in verse 9, Jethro rejoiced for all the good that the Lord had done to Israel. No caveats there, no qualifications there, all the good that Yahweh had done for Israel. How do we explain all this then? Well, let's put it this way. If verse 8 in our Bible simply read this, then Moses told his father-in-law all the hardship that had come upon them in the way. If verse 8 simply read that, if that was the sum total of Moses' report to Jethro, if all Jethro heard about was the hunger and the thirst, if all he heard about was the trials, then I'm sure verses 9 to 12 wouldn't have happened. And we would never have had Jethro exclaiming, now I know Yahweh is greater than all gods. I'm rejoicing in the Lord's goodness to you. That wouldn't have happened. But you see, Jethro, yes, he hears about the hunger and thirst. Yes, he hears about the trials. But he also hears about the context of those trials. The Passover, the crossing of the Red Sea, the recent defeat of the Amalekites. And in that context then, the trials, though as we said, they are serious enough in themselves, in that context, the trials are dwarfed. They are made small and relatively trifling. That night, you see, there in Egypt, when the destroying angel passed through and struck down the firstborn, that night, the firstborn sons of the Israelites could also legitimately, justly, righteously have been struck down. They deserved it. We said that, didn't we? It's clear enough in our Bibles that they were idolaters in Egypt. It wasn't just the Egyptians. They could have had their firstborn killed that night. But they didn't. Their firstborn was spared. There at the rock at Horeb. Do you remember we said a couple of weeks ago, as Moses struck with that staff, the same staff with which he'd struck the Nile in an act of judgment and it had turned to blood, the same staff with which he'd struck the dust and it had turned into gnats in an act of judgment. Moses could have struck the rock and water could have come gushing out in such a way that it drowned the Israelites like the water drowned the Egyptians in the Red Sea. And again, that would have been just. Because these Israelites were moaning and they were grumbling and they were being so ungrateful, and God had every right to drown them the way he drowned the Egyptians, but he didn't. He spared them. God, for no other reason than his marvelous grace, on Passover night had spared the Israelites. The rock of Horeb had spared the Israelites. And compared then to what they had been spared from, what they had not been spared from, some hunger, Some thirst there in the wilderness. It was nothing. It was nothing. And surely we can say this morning as Christian believers that the same is true for us in our trials. Yes, our trials are tough. Perhaps your trials this morning are tough, and I don't for one moment want to sound glib this morning, because the Bible takes trials seriously. And trials can, in this world, be deeply, deeply, deeply hurtful and painful and disorientating. But at the cross, God has removed from us the everlasting, unmitigated suffering of hell, which we deserve. That's the context in which he chooses at times to inflict certain problems on our lives, in our health, in our finances, in our families. But you see, what has been removed from us at the cross and what is being inflicted upon us now in this life, the two things are not comparable. They're not of equal weight. What has been removed is this colossal damnation that we should have been tormented with everlastingly. What is inflicted, by comparison, is small. And so if we're clear, not only on the consequences that God brings about from our trials, but also on the wider context of our trials, that context being salvation, that context being the cross, that context being the removal of the hell we deserve, then surely we will find our trials a little more bearable and a little bit more easy to cope with. May God help us to be clear on these two great truths. Amen. Well, we're going to